you want to start just by reading a little bit from towards the beginning of the book, maybe one of the first times it seems that Marie's experiencing drugs?
Sure. I'll set it up a little bit and then start reading. Marie's gone to Miss Anglin's house, and they've actually done some drugs. They did a couple lines of OxyContin. The party by the fire and the car were moving toward each other across time and space. They would meet, and everyone would be together, and Marie would be there, too. Everything made Marie laugh. Miss Anglin's car window that wouldn't roll down. The whiny man on the CD player singing and playing guitar. And finally, the car and the party did meet in space and time, and the car stopped. Marie felt herself glide out of the car and around the mud pit and down the road to the party. Marie wanted to talk to everyone there. She had something to say, even to people she'd never seen before. Marie felt taller, and she liked the way she felt when she walked, like her joints were jangling, like she was tall and limber, moving easy over the ground. And it felt like everyone noticed her and wanted to talk to her as much as she wanted to talk to them. Everything was happening for a reason, and she knew what that reason was, even if she couldn't say it out loud. Nobody reminded her of anything, and everybody at the party was good. The only thing missing was water. She wanted to dive into a pool and swim, or a lake or a river or something. It would have felt so good to move her body around in some water. It would have made the night totally complete. Marie ran into Miss Anglin, and she was saying to no one, "How did we come to be here?" She was saying it over and over again, not talking to Marie or anyone else, asking God, it seemed like, with her palms up, cigarette burning in one hand, head cocked to one side. "Man, that's all I want to know. I want to know how we came to be here." She shook her head and brought the cigarette to her lips, left the other arm outstretched. "And here's the other thing I need to know." She paused and blew out a stream of smoke. "Why is he not here?" That pissed Marie off. She knew what Miss Anglin was talking about. She knew who Miss Anglin was talking about. Miss Anglin, who Shane was done with, who he was trying to get away from, was now bringing him up. When all Marie wanted to do was get away, forget about the way her mother wailed at the funeral and the broken shell that was left of her dad. Why was she talking about this now? Just when Marie had almost been able to forget what happened, even just for a few hours, Miss Anglin ruined it.
And Shane, who Marie's talking about right there, is her brother who passed away just before this scene, or a few weeks, I think, before the scene. And can you talk a little bit about Marie's parents and how they kind of, you mentioned that this tragedy, really, they weren't able to cope. They weren't prepared for this terrible tragedy as he was going off to college, as you mentioned. How did Marie's parents respond to this?
Well, her dad kind of really fell into a fog. He just wasn't able to cope. I guess he was probably pretty depressed. And her mom was just kind of absent, I think. She just threw herself into her work and her other commitments, and I think that's how she coped with it. And it kind of left Marie to her own devices, in a way. This next part that I'll read is about one way that Marie's parents kind of deal with her and how she is slipping away from them. Marie shut the back door of the darkened house. She had walked through yards and wet grass, so she slipped off her shoes on the rug and held them in her hand, trying her best to be quiet and not disturb her sleeping parents. Then there was a flash. The light in the kitchen flipped on. The suddenness of the light scared her, but she didn't look up from her shoes. She thought it would be her mom, but when she finally raised her head, there was a different hand on the light switch. "Dad?" she said. It came out involuntarily, like a breath. He stood there, his hair a messy halo around his head. He didn't say anything, just let his hand fall from the switch to his side. He wore a gray, long-handled top and gray jogging pants. His beard was as off-kilter as his hair, the effect a circle of brown around his whole head, wild and uncertain where to go. Marie let the shoes drop. No reason to try and keep grass and water off the floor now. "What's going on here?" he finally asked. He didn't sound exhausted. He didn't sound like he was ready to give up. She didn't say anything, but moved her arms so her backpack would fall down into her hands. She started across the kitchen. He moved so she couldn't get by him in the doorway. "Where have you been?" he asked, his arms outstretched. He seemed bigger than the shell he'd wasted away to after Shane died. "I'm going to bed, to my room." "Nope," he shook his head, "you're not." Marie started to turn back to the door she came in, but he stopped her, spun her back around. "I asked you a question." "What the hell do you care?" "I asked you a question I expect to answer." Marie shook her head. She saw something in her dad's face she hadn't seen in a long time. It scared her. It always scared her because she knew what it meant. It was the same look that she had when she was so angry she could break dishes or rip stuff apart. He grabbed her by the arm and started kicking her at her ankles and feet. "Dad, by God," his teeth were clenched. "By God, I'm not." He tried to say more, but the words were garbled, his mouth so taut the sound couldn't come out. He kept kicking her, and it hurt the way he had a hold of her arm. She dropped her backpack and tried to get away, move back from him, but he kept after it, just kicking and kicking until she was backed all the way across the kitchen and into a corner by the door. He still kicked, mostly hitting the wall around her legs. She felt tears then, and she finally screamed at him to stop. He didn't stop. He hit her on the arm, then hit the wall behind her, his teeth still clenched. "What do you think you're doing? Do you think that all this is a game or something? You think you can come in and come and go as you please around here? You think you've been promoted? You think you've been promoted to the boss around here?" He kept kicking. "I'll be damned if I'm going to let you turn into some trashy dope-taking whore." He hit the wall again. "Go ahead and put me in the grave. Your brother started it, and now you're going to finish. Go ahead. Just go ahead and put the knife in my heart. Go on." He stopped. He stepped back from her then and stopped the kicking. He went to the island and opened a drawer, but didn't find what he was looking for. He opened another drawer and cussed as he knocked the kitchen utensils around. The noise hurt Marie's head, and tears were still coming. She wiped them with her sleeve. He found what he was looking for, a long knife with a black handle. He walked back to Marie, planted his feet, pointed the tip of the blade over his heart. "Go on. Go on and do it. Quicker than how you're doing it now. Go on." Marie shook her head. She looked at his eyes, but could not tell what was going on there. "Please, please," she said. "Please what? Please what? You're staying out doing God knows what. You might as well just get it over with. Just do it." He held the blade and told her to take the handle, but she wouldn't. "Just put me out of my misery." His voice was so low now, it was hard to hear him. "Please don't," she said, hoping that would end it. The knife clattered to the floor. "Then stop this. Just stop it." He turned away from her, and his tears started. "I can't take it." He left the kitchen and went to the living room and laid back down on the couch. She picked up her shoes and her backpack and went upstairs to her room. She took her clothes off and got in the shower. She stayed there for a long time, then crawled into bed but did not fall asleep.
And that's kind of one of the scenes where throughout the book, the dad is kind of absent and, as you said, kind of withdrawn or in a fog, but that's definitely the most we hear from him. It's very dramatic. Seems out of character for him in some ways, right?
Yeah. I think he just kind of woke up and realized what was going on around him and where his daughter had been and what was going on with her. I think it was just his last and maybe only real effort to try to get her to wake up.
Yeah, it definitely opens up the debate of if her parents had been a little more supportive or been there, would Marie have fallen into this pattern of drug abuse and made these friends, and really essentially she leaves home, and that it does seem as if she probably wouldn't have had that vacuum at home. She might not have left and joined these other people. Is that kind of how you thought about her, I guess, downward spiral into drug abuse and with this other group of people?
Yeah, I think she was looking for a family when she found the Owenses. And even though they were wild and they were a lot different than her own family, I think she wanted that and she craved it. And that's one of the main reasons why she fell in with them, I think.
Yeah, and in the beginning, she's really drawn to them. She's drawn to Bobo. He's sort of like the superstar among his family members, but he also just embodies this like ultra physical buff. You know, he does canoeing. She's enchanted with him. Bobo is kind of the older brother. He's older 20s, maybe about 30, Marie guesses, and he's been working construction in Indiana and comes back. Can you describe a little bit how Marie sees him in those first few scenes and who he is and what his dreams are?
Yeah, so when Bobo's been in Indiana and he's been, like you said, working construction, he's been saving his money because he wants to come back home and start a Outfitters, right? He wants to, it's a beautiful place. His county, Larkin County, is beautiful. And they have a river, and he wants to set up a store down there, kind of an outfitter store, and rent canoes and kayaks and do excursions on the river. That's his big hope and dream. That's the legitimate side of what he wants to do anyway.
Who in your life were you thinking of when you wrote this book, when you thought about Bobo and you thought about Marie and wanted to write about these characters?
Well, there are a lot of people, really. I moved back to my home county in about 2003. I lived in Lexington for quite a while and worked up here. And when I moved back, it seemed like there was a whole generation that had just been really decimated. There's no other way to say it. They'd been decimated by what was going on there in terms of drugs. These were kids that I knew growing up. These were kids that I taught how to swim at the swimming pool and knew from teaching vacation Bible school. And it was across all class lines. It was everybody. And so that's what I started from. And I also started from, especially with Bobo, because, you know, you see people, and maybe you didn't know them before they became addicted. When you're addicted, I think it's hard to be human in a way, and it's hard to see people who are addicted as human sometimes. But I wanted to think about Bobo as a kid. You know, Bobo is definitely a kid's nickname, right? So that's kind of why I even gave him the name, because he was a kid at one point, and he had dreams, and he had big ambitions, but like a lot of people, the addiction really overpowers that drive and interest. So that's who I was thinking about when I wrote those characters.
It is such a roller coaster of a book. I enjoyed it. I think it's really important for us to kind of put ourselves in the shoes of people, because there's all kinds of ways that people get addicted and fall into lives of chaos and despair. But, you know, empathy in some ways is probably one of the things that we can do better and better. And your book does a really great job, I think, of helping bring someone's life into a sort of, we become more aware of what it really is like to go through this girl's shoes. So I thank you for that. I think it's really important. What brought you to want to do this book as a coming-of-age book right now?
Well, kind of along the lines of what you were saying, and I thank you for those comments, because that's exactly what I was trying to do. I really, in a way, wanted to, it's a fictional book, of course, but in a way I wanted to make a record of what's going on in my area and with the people that I love in my area.
Do you have children?
I do, yeah. I got two girls. I got one that just turned 14 and one who will be 10 next week.
In writing this, Marie's 17, were you thinking as you were writing Marie, like, what if this happened to my daughter? What would I do? Or were you wondering as a parent what you would do in a situation like this?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's been so widespread, and it, you know, and you look at people in your county and you know people that you've grown up with who've succumbed. You know, I know a lot of people who've passed away. Yeah, it's something I think about every day. And it's, you could do, I know people, parents and brothers and sisters of people who've been addicted, it's super hard to pinpoint when it starts or why it starts. So it's something you have to be, I think you do as a parent, you think about it all the time.
And have you, when you were 17, what was it like for you during that time? Did you ever face any kind of alcohol or drug interactions or addictions that kind of came up as you were writing this book?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know how much I want to get into this. I don't want my kids to hear this quite yet. But yeah, I think everybody at 17, and that's the thing too, is that your brain isn't really fully formed at that age. You know, you don't always have the best judgment. And one thing you do when you're that age could influence and impact your whole life. And that's what I think about with Marie. She made a couple not so great decisions, and the outcome is going to be with her forever. And it's the weird thing about being 17 is because you're old enough to do these things and have a little more freedom. But you don't always realize the impact that your decisions are going to have on the rest of your life.
Well, thank you, Carrie, for so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Roxy. I really appreciate getting to talk to you. I've enjoyed your program as well. So I'm really looking forward to how this turns out. And I really, really want to thank you for setting this up and getting to talk to you.
Carrie Mullins is the author of Night Garden, a novel that debuted this year from Old Cove Press.